Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited. Subscribe to us through iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. Joining us tonight on Movie Geeks United. We're going to get to some great movie talk in just a moment. But first up, our feature guest for the evening is none other than actress Danielle Harris. If anyone deserves the title of the quintessential modern screen queen, it's more than likely Danielle. She, of course, first hit it big in the Halloween franchise at a very early age. And her new movie is titled Shiver. It's a horror movie in which she co-stars with John Jarrett from Wolf Creek. It is now available on DVD. Here's Danielle to tell us all about it. I liked the movie a lot. I thought it was really disturbing, which you know, I guess is the point of the film.
Great, that's the plan.
so what made you want to do this one?
You know, mostly because I have not been a lead yet in a movie where I was essentially playing close to my age. You know, I just was kind of getting back in the genre, and I had done you know, supportings and other roles, but this was really just an opportunity to kind of tackle some pretty hardcore scenes, and I was looking for something to challenge me. I'd been getting a lot of offers at the time for, you know, the bad girl, the best friend, the sassy one that has a pretty awesome death, and then this was one that I got to not have to be that strong character, but to find my strength throughout it and be a lead, and I love John Jarrett, and I just really liked the script. You know, I met with Robert Weinbach, our producer, and we had a meeting about it because I loved it, and he gave me the book, and while I was reading the book before I actually got the job, I got up from reading and made sure my alarm was on and closed my windows and stuff, and I thought, okay, I have to do this movie because I'm totally scared for the first time, and I don't get scared very easy when I read scripts because I can see how we're going to shoot it. So knowing that I was really in it and involved, it was exciting for me to be a part of it.
That's interesting to me because, I mean, you've been acting for so long, and you've made a particular splash in the horror genre, and I'm sure that you get offered a ton of movies, and a lot of them you probably feel like, you know, I can do this on autopilot. So when you actually choose a movie, is there a criteria that you adhere to?
It kind of depends. You know, yes, there's a lot of things that factor into it. Usually the first thing is, you know, where are we shooting? How many days are we shooting? Just to kind of see if it's going to be realistic. You know, when people call and say, oh, we have, you know, we're shooting it in 6 days and we have $100,000 for our budget and we're going to film 25 pages a day, you're kind of like, oh, God, I don't really know if I want to do that. I've done so many of those. I've learned so much from doing, you know, ultra-low-budget genre films. That it's really hard. It's really, really hard. And I like a little more time. Most of them that we do, even the one that I'm working on right now, they're mostly 15-day shoots, which is also very, very challenging. But it depends on where we're shooting. If, you know, if I'm running around half naked and I know we're shooting upstate New York in, like, December, I'm kind of like, oh, I don't know. I have to really love a script to want to put myself through the torture, literally.
Yeah.
It's character stuff. It's, you know, who I'm playing opposite. It all kind of factors into it. If I find that it's a character that I have not done before, after I did Halloween 2, I thought, okay, no more victims. And that, making that decision was like what ended up, I think, allowing me to take on more final girl roles, which is what I started doing. And now those roles are sort of what I've been doing the last couple of years. And now I'm kind of like wanting to go back to, now I want to just go behind the camera, because being the lead and having to make it to the end, you have to go through quite a bit to get there. And, you know, I'm not so young anymore. I've been doing it for a while. So, as fun and as exciting as it is, it's gotta be something different for me to want to do it again.
I want to talk about your behind the scenes work in just a second, but you know, when you're doing films that shoot on something like a 15-day schedule, do you feel like you're given enough opportunity to kind of fully invest and explore the character you're playing?
You know, I think you sort of find it. You find it as you go, and you really have to just do your homework. I mean, I'm doing See No Evil 2 right now, and I sat down with the Saska twins before we shot, and it really broke down, you know, where I was, because I knew we were jumping around so much. I needed to really think about where I wanted to be emotionally, and making all of those choices beforehand and having it be different, because sometimes these characters are written, and there's not even enough time to really explain it when you're on set. Or on the paper, the emotional journey that I think you have to take to play a lead. And so it's really our job to kind of make sure that happens. And I want to do it. I mean, I will never allow myself to phone it in. So while you sometimes find it on the second or third take, you always go in kind of knowing what your intention is, and I try to just put myself in that situation. And that's why the characters are a lot like me. My fiance the other day was watching on set. He came to visit, and I asked him what he thought about, you know, what he liked the most, what he thought would you like the scenes, were they good? And he said, I don't know, because you're just like, you're you, like you're just like being you. So I don't know if it's like how to tell if it's good or not, because I just see you. And I was like, that's great. That's perfect. That's exactly what I want. So I don't want to play at anything. I just put myself there and sort of go with it. And it's all organic. You know, you put yourself in a situation where you're being attacked by somebody and your body just takes over. And all that, you know, all the screaming and the crying and, you know, the fear and all that is really authentic to the situation. So it helps. It definitely helps.
Yeah, I've always been amazed by your work. I mean, I am a huge fan of yours. And just because of the...
Thank you.
I mean, your work is so incredibly emotional and raw and right there on the surface and so visceral. And, I mean, sometimes it exhausts me just to see
it's
what
exhausting.
You're being put through.
You
make it so real. tell me about John Jarrett, because from the outside, it you know, a spectator would think this man is completely unhinged. So what is he like in person?
It's so funny. In order to play unhinged, I think you have to be in such control. You know, for me, I'm sort of the same way. Like I'm very kind of level-headed and mellow, and you know, I don't get angry very easy in real life, and I see the bright side of everything, and I'm like the nurturer, caretaker. You know, so for me to play like, you know, the badass in movies, even though I know that I've got it in me, when it comes to my work, I definitely wouldn't mess with me, But I mean, I cry very easily, so it's funny. I'm very sensitive, which I think nobody would know, and I think a lot of these killers, you know, bad guys, tough guys, are these really nice, really sweet, you know, family men, essentially, that just kind of have fun playing at this. You can't really be like that if you're playing those roles. I don't think you have the mental capacity to be able to do that.
Sure. Before I let you go, I want to ask about Among Friends, because I saw a screening of this that you had earlier this year at Gasparilla, and I enjoyed it very much. And it's the oddest thing. I've interviewed you three or four times, but I have such a social anxiety, I couldn't come up to you and shake your hand. I'm like so nervous in person. But,
What's the matter with you?
I have no idea, but I love the movie very much. And I would imagine, I mean, the long list of directors that you've worked for throughout your career, at what point did you start really observing them and studying them and taking things from them?
You know, I think I actually always have been. I've never really had a desire to be an actress, you know. I've loved what I've done because it's allowed me to be on set and be part of the process of making a movie. But it was never about needing to be in front of the camera. I'm around a lot of actors and actresses, and I don't really have a ton in common with them, where I can sit down with the Saska twins and I could talk movies all day long because they're looking at it from a different point of view. And I think that, as well as, you know, Adam Green and Rob Zombie, like all we did was talk shop. I'm not one to go back to my trailer. I love talking to the DPs and, you know, I asked to see, if it's storyboarded, I asked to see shot lists every day. Like I really wanted to, I love the process of making a film. So unfortunately, you saw Among Friends. It was not, we didn't have the Blu-ray, which is supposed to be shot on Blu-ray, and the sound was all messed up. And, you know, I know you saw me kept, like, running in and out, like, 10 times trying to fix things, and I wasn't extremely happy with the way it played there. But and we shot that movie in 10 days also. So I definitely learned a ton. I've learned more from the directors that have had that have struggled making movies than I have from the directors that have not, because you get to sort of see them fall apart and have to fix it and put it back together again. And that's, I think, what you learn. When a director's got it all together, then you don't ever really know what's going on because you don't see shit fall apart.
Yeah.
So I've learned from the directors that are new more than the directors that are seasoned.
You've seen so many movies that you've starred in front of an audience. Is it a different kind of level of nerves when you unleash, you know, a movie that you directed in front of an audience because it's your baby?
Oh, yeah, because I have no one to blame it on but myself.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it really is, you are in control. It's all you. As an actor, I can sit here and say, well, I came on set, I did my job, and then it's out of my hands. Mm-hmm. And it really is very, you know, it's a lot of movies that I've done have come out much different than what I had expected. So this is a chance for me to, and I know that the actors that were in Among Friends did not know that there was any kind of comedic element to the movie. They didn't know that it was going to look like that. They didn't know it was going to sound like that. They had no idea. They thought that they were just making this hardcore, you know, intense psychological thriller about a twisted woman that decides to sort of take it into her own hands and prove a point. And I wanted to make it like a good documentary. I love documentaries. They're my favorite. And for me, it was always about never allowing the audience to pick a side. You know, leaving going, I don't know if I wanted the people to survive or if I wanted the killer to survive. Like, you don't really know, because neither one of them are really, like, I like to be able to root for both. And I feel like a lot of horror movies, you kind of root for the killer because people are so dumb most of the time, except the roles that I play, of course. But, you know, that's kind of changed. It depends on if you're doing a slasher film or if you're doing a psychological thriller, then the characters are sort of a bit different. So, I love being behind the camera. That's what I want to do.
Okay, that was Danielle Harris. The new movie is titled Shiver. Pick it up now. It is available on DVD. Let me bring on my co-host. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Hello.
How have you guys been the past week?
Been okay, man. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Didn't you go up to New York or something? I went up to New York and I came back last night, so it was very short, but it was the first time I've been away in 9 years anywhere.
Oh,
so, yeah, well, I mean, that's just how life is, you know.
I didn't fly.
I mean, I would like to fly, but that's the shuttle, while it is, you know, the quickest way to get there, that's very expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know.
How is it to ride on a train nowadays? It's been forever since I've been on a train.
It's good. I liked it. It's a lot better than the Metro, which we took to get, or the DC Metro, which we took to get down to Union Station. I'll tell you that. But I like it. It's nice. I hadn't been on the train, the Amtrak for decades, but it was I enjoyed it. It was nice.
That's a pretty fast ride too. I remember going up, taking the train. You know, it's been
two and a half hours.
I want to say about two and a half.
It was quicker out, you know, when you come back, it's quicker, I guess, whenever you go. But it was about, I would say, roughly 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good.
But you know, like, leaving from Atlanta to go to New York, it's like the slow train until you hit D.C., and then you get on the electric train, and then it goes, like, much quicker, so...
Well, that's because you got the booze going. I mean, everyone's just like, yeah, we're in D.C. We got to get drunk. It's so depressing there. We got to get out of here. As far away from there as possible.
On this episode of Travel Geeks United.
Yeah, really? No, this is good, though. This is good.
You know,
I
will say that I went to New York City one time, and I went with a girlfriend of mine that went to college up in Connecticut. So we took the bus, and it felt taking the bus to New York – it felt like almost I was in one of those, I don't know, I hate to say this, like the back of the bus, like a back of a truck or something where they smuggle people over the border. But
yeah.
I remember I landed. We got to New York City. I stepped off the bus, and it was a miserable New York day. It was cold and rainy, and the rain was like sheets of rock hitting you. And so I was walking down the sidewalk, and first encounter I had was a transvestite that came on to me. I was like, yeah, okay, this is New York City. This is...
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. Anyway, quality movies back in theaters and quality movies performing very well. Do you think this time of year, of course I'm talking about Captain Phillips and Gravity, the top spots in the box office this weekend, do you think this time of year people are just relieved have quality movies that they can go to, like a post-summer kind of refresher?
I think so. I think that's part of it. I also just think you have two very compelling stories, and the one, I mean, especially Gravity, that you have to see in a theater. I think it actually is the first film maybe since Avatar that you really feel compelled to go see it in the best possible presentation possible, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. I don't think you really feel it for a lot of these, and I've seen things in 3D that I'm really like, really? Why was that in 3D? I mean, you know, you feel like you've been cheated massively, but with Gravity, you don't. Gravity, but it's not just all effects, I think, in Gravity. I think there's a very compelling story there, too, the more I think about it. I mean, obviously, I think the effects and the 3D presentation is obviously this point points, but when you really get down to it, there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I also think Captain Phillips is very good too, regardless of what the story that's breaking up, and it's all false.
The story isn't saying that it's false. It's just saying that here's the whisper campaign to discredit truth-based movie, but basically they're saying that the real Captain Phillips kind of cut corners and actually led his crew and his ship into waters that were not international waters. Trying to save money, so he took a 300 mile route rather than a 600 mile route, and that's what got him to close to Somalian waters. But he contends that it wouldn't have mattered if they were 600 miles or 1,200 miles out, that it would have they would have still come, you know.
Yeah.
So, but to answer your original question, Jamie, I do think that people at least a certain crowd. I mean, the Gravity numbers, at least as far as age wise goes, it's primarily people 30 and over going to see Gravity. So it's really this season is really a time for people who have abdicated going to the movies for the rest of the year because it's for kids, and you know, most movies are for kids.
I want to ask you guys about that.
I would actually say that it's a break from going to the movies for people who are under 30. So they're
question though. Let me ask you both a question. This prize demographic, the young demographic, it doesn't make much sense anymore since a majority of the country is getting older. I would think you'd want to cater somewhat more towards this demographic, even though we are talking to a gentleman yesterday about this. While that, you know, it is always said that the older generation has more money, that may not be true anymore because a lot of people, you know, medical expenses and savings have dwindled because of
that
medical
expense. They're paying for their kids. You know,
they're paying for their kids. Yeah. And in some cases that the younger kids, not the kids, but the older kids are paying for the parents too in some ways. But does it make, maybe the part of the problem isn't so much movies are dying, it's that the Hollywood is, and this goes for TV, it goes for everything actually, is that they're marketing to the wrong generation. Because that younger generation really doesn't care about the movies as much, unless it's something like a Hunger Games, which I understand, I think that's great, based on a young adult novel, that makes sense.
I think if, you know, there's a difference between Captain Phillips money and Iron Man money, and I mean, if you want to play in the billion-dollar grocer game, you got to have a movie that appeals to young people. You have to.
You're right. I agree with that, but I just
I
think
mean, a Merchant
think maybe...
a Merchant Ivory movie will never make $1 billion worldwide.
No, it won't.
That's true.
And that's another thing, you just said worldwide, and it is the global grosses are becoming the most important thing. And, you know, Dean and I brought this up a couple of years ago with a movie like Greenberg, which we both loved a lot and wondered why it wasn't doing better. But a movie like Greenberg can never do well, truly well. If a movie like Greenberg makes $20 million at the end of its run domestically,
that's astounding.
It's like with the cable. You know what the Breaking Bad numbers, they're great for cable, but if that was a network show, they'd be like, we gotta cancel this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but there's also something, and this is why, I mean, when you set out to make a movie that grosses $1 billion worldwide, like many of these tentpole movies do frequently,
mm-hmm.
it has to appeal to everybody. So from a creative standpoint, you have to make sure that in making sure that you don't alienate any demographic, the challenge is how am I going to make something that's not completely homogenized and watered down and has nothing to say, nothing of value? You know, that's the tremendous challenge, and that's why when one of these blockbuster movies is actually fulfilling creatively, that's as much of a feat as an art house film that reaches an audience, I think, you know?
I agree with that. I agree with that a lot. Something like Gravity let's think of some other, there are some other films, though, that have in recent times done that, but you were absolutely right, Jamie. It is when they do say something, when they're just not about checkbook balances and everything. You're absolutely right.
And
I think
plus
Gravity
plus they're not in the middle of the road business anymore. They're not in the business of producing so many $20-30 million budgeted movies anymore. They want to gross big numbers, and so they continue to risk big by making them at budgets of $200-300 million each. I mean, they haven't. I don't know if they would. When Paranormal Activity came out, and it was made for $50,000 and grossed 100-some-odd million, I mean that's a greater percentage of return on investment than any of these blockbusters, really.
True.
And yet, you know, they know that they can make $1 billion, but they'll still show. There was some article that came out online last week. The fancy math, like the fuzzy math that studios engage in, and how the hell they picture like a summary of how much they make on a movie, like a Forrest Gump, and they end up saying, no, we lost money on Forrest Gump. And you know that's bullshit. They never expected Forrest Gump to make those numbers. It became a global cultural phenomenon out of nowhere. So, I mean, there's no way that movie could be in the, is it in the red or the black?
In the red.
I was in the red. There was no way. I mean, there's no way whatsoever that they couldn't pay Winston Groom his royalties or whatever. That was bunk. I mean, that's BS. That's a lot of BS. But they do that. They get away with this. They still get away with it. We're in 2013. They still get away with this madness.
Like its own little Hollywood government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, but you're right.
With a bunch of criminals holding the reins.
So out of the blue last week, I got two emails from two different publicists that say, we're trying to get you Oliver Stone. And look, I've been trying to get Oliver Stone for 7 years. And I've always wanted to talk to Oliver Stone. So he has The Untold History of the United States. It's now on Blu-ray. He has JFK that's being re-released in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's doing lots of press for that, and that's what they're trying to get him on our show to discuss. But my point in bringing this up is it was just announced what his next project will be a couple of days ago, and that's a big Martin Luther King biopic with Jamie Foxx starring as King.
We could use that.
How come they can't cast somebody who actually... Every time you see Martin Luther King portrayed in a movie, and it doesn't happen very often, but at least these days, it's always some rail thin guy. Like Martin Luther King was kind of chubby. Like, is Jamie Foxx going to eat a few pizzas before he does this movie? Because
Jamie Foxx is going to go the Raging Bull route. Okay, don't you worry about that. But
Jeffrey Wright
was a good Martin Luther King. I thought Jeffrey Wright.
Vain.
Jeffrey Wright
yeah.
was a good. He was very
yeah.
good in Boycott. That was
who played
HBO
King
movie.
In the who played King in the mini? Oh, Paul Winfield played him in the miniseries.
He was a great.
That's okay. He's got the right body type. Like I just I'm tired of seeing things like J. Edgar and they cast freaking DiCaprio as J. Edgar Hoover when J. Edgar Hoover was also a dumpy kind of guy. They can't cast anybody. They just can't cast anybody ugly ever,
Well, look at Bob Hoskins was good and Nixon as J. Edgar.
I know, but he's not the lead. He's in it for two scenes. He's I'm talking about if you're going to do a movie with these things, they're talking about doing the Janis Joplin movie, and you know who they want to cast in it? Amy Adams, who's basically 20 years, first of all, she's 20 years too old for the role. I mean, she's 42, and Janis Joplin was 27 when she died. And
right,
then,
right.
And then plus, Amy Adams is drop-dead gorgeous, and, Janis Joplin was, dumpy. That's part of her appeal.
Yeah, but
don't
you think, Dean, that actors deserve a chance to act? I mean, isn't Charlize Theron drop-dead gorgeous? And wasn't she the last person you think should play Eileen Wuornos?
I guess if they're going to slap some makeup on her, then it'll be okay. But I do think, come on, you can't deny, 42-year-old playing the 27-year-old. It's like
Zoe and Pink were going to play Janis Joplin at times, too.
That would have been better,
No, Zoe would not have, I don't think, if Zoe did that, they always said the reason she didn't do it, she would ruin her singing voice. Because that was
With Zoe, she just feels too demure to me.
Yeah, she's too demure, but it was also a vocal thing because they said if she took the part to try to sound like her, they said she would ruin her singing voice. She could never sing again.
She's got a little simple sort of chirpy voice, and Joplin is belting out for the next state.
I think Pink would have been an interesting choice, but I don't know. They've been trying to do this for decades.
Years ago, they were talking about getting Lily Taylor to play the role, and she's perfect for the role. She's perfect for it.
But look, also you got to keep in mind that this is Lee Daniels, and he always casts against type. I mean, that's his deal.
Is it? I mean, I don't know. You definitely
every character in The Butler, outside of the two leads, all the presidents are pretty much against type. Stuff like, Precious, he cast like a comedian in the mother role, the abusive, monstrous mother role.
Shadow Box, whatever.
Cuba Gooding Jr. and Helen Mirren together.
What you're talking about is stunt casting, not casting against Pike. But it is stunt casting.
Well, it's the same thing. Isn't it the same thing?
It's kind of the same thing. You would never have thought Cuba Gooding Jr. in Shadowbox was the first good role he had in a long time. And Cuba Gooding Jr. was at the time of Shadowbox was considered washed up and a joke. So I see what Jamie's saying. And would you have ever thought Nancy Reagan to be played by Jane Fonda? I mean, that's the farthest thing from my mind. I mean,
well, yeah, okay, but still.
And Monique, did you ever think Monique, well, you know, you're watching Soul Plane or whatever, Monique is going to ever win an Oscar?
Honestly, I had never heard of Monique before Precious. Like, I had a vague, she had a vague place in the pop culture firmament for me, but not like really something like she was like a talk show host or something. That's what I
see.
Knew.
But I always love that. I mean, I always love when actors are cast against type. It's something that excites me. And how can an actor know what heights they can reach unless they're given an opportunity to play outside of their comfort zone?
I'm not advocating casting only blind actors to play blind people, or like what happened with musical chairs a couple of years ago was people the handicapped community like said, oh well, it's wrong to have actors playing actors who aren't actually paralyzed playing people in wheelchairs, and I was like, that's absurd. I'm not talking about that. But I'm just saying, you know, there is good casting and then there is bad casting, and sometimes bad casting can be overcome with a great performance. I agree, but sometimes bad casting is just bad casting. Like mm-hmm. in The Butler, for instance, a lot of that stuff is just bad casting. So
did you just say
I mean,
in The Butler?
In The Butler, yes, in The Butler.
Like, let's look at some of the great
in the
Henry Fonda, Once Upon a Time in the West, is still one of the best.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm not saying that actors need to only play the things that they seems like they're completely right for. But I'm just saying. Sometimes just somebody is completely wrong for something, you know. So, I mean.
All right. So my point of this initial discussion was, are we happy that Oliver Stone is back to doing a political film?
Yes. Even if this film, I would just like to see him do something because I only watched a couple episodes of this past show, this thing, and it's not accurate. This is what happens when your older brother's an historian. He fact checks everything that's on, but... I do think I want to see Oliver Stone make something that gets him in trouble. Not something that just, but gets him in trouble from all sides of the aisle.
Yeah.
That's what we love. That's the Oliver Stone we love.
It's, it's kind of an untested screenwriter who did the script for the King biopic. But it takes place, it's a full life biopic right up to his assassination. And Spielberg is producing it. So it's the first time Spielberg's collaborated with Oliver Stone.
Mm. But look, even Oliver Stone has made only like, I mean, I'm not a huge Oliver Stone fan, but there's just two movies I think don't work. I'm really just flat, Alexander and World Trade Center. I just don't think work at all. I think the problem with W is it's too soon. I have the same feeling toward W that I have towards the Fifth Estate movie that's coming out this week. There's the story hasn't really ended at all yet to really make a movie about it. But W, there's no doubt about it, W is a fascinating movie to watch.
I agree.
You can't, you can't turn your eyes away from it. It may not be the best movie, but it's just like, wow, this is fascinating.
For me, outside of Salvador, W is my favorite of his political movies. Because I think it's surprising that the film actually has kind of a sympathetic view of George W. Bush's position in the world or whatever. That was surprising to me. So I liked it on that basis. Plus the lead performance is really terrific. So
mm-hmm.
The fact that it was so of its time was also, of course, surprising too, because I don't think I've ever seen a movie about a sitting president released while the guy was still president.
It's only Primary Colors is the only one that comes to mind.
I guess so. I guess Primary Colors, but
and you know what, and he's always kind of tinkered with that, with being incredibly prescient. I mean, I remember the week before Natural Born Killers opened or something, he inserted a shot of the O.J. verdict at the end of it, you know,
yes.
and because that just happened. And so that felt like,
you
oh,
mean,
my God,
I
just saw that happen on the TV last week, for God's sakes, and it's in this movie.
You mean the Bronco chase, right? Not the Bronco, but the Bronco chase. That's what you mean.
Okay. I guess so. So I'm excited by that. You know, the thing that I miss from Oliver Stone is a sense, and I always say it, a sense of that passion that bleeds from the screen. So whether you like the movies or not, movies like Salvador, Platoon, Born on the Fourth, especially for me, JFK, all of those were like incredible cries. I mean, these movies just screamed at you. They were incredibly passionate. And I'm wondering if Oliver Stone can get back to that, if he still has it in him, if his inclination is even to go back to that. Part of me thinks, no, probably not. And even in its own way, you know, a movie like Nixon is a return to very classical storytelling for him. And it's the work of a very mature, introspective man, as opposed to a lot of the movies that came before it, I think.
I agree with that, and Nixon is one of the great tragic portrayals, you know, epics of our time. It's just a fascinating movie. It's another thing, he manages to get you engrossed. I don't care if you hate his guts, there's no denying that he creates a fascinating, addictive film for you to watch.
I saw this Guerrilla Disney movie. And I'm I'm not talking about Mighty Joe Young. Escape from Tomorrow, the movie that was shot, an independent movie that was shot like incognito on Walt Disney property. It's essentially a man loses his job the same weekend that he's taking his family, his wife and two kids, out to the Disney theme parks. Mm-hmm. And he's slowly going crazy while he's in the park. It's a neat little experiment, and it doesn't hold you for its entire length. It kind of loses its welcome after a while. But, you know, it is admirable and crazy how they were able to do it to begin with. I'd say probably 60-65% of it is clearly shot in the actual parks. And then there's some elements that they cheat on, where they have the actors in front of a green screen with scenes of Disney playing behind them. But those scenes are done in a stylized way that kind of reflects his state of mind, so it works dramatically. It's almost like a very Lynchian experience after a while, because as it gets progressively loonier, it's played very darkly and surrealistically. So it's definitely weird. It gets weirder and weirder. There's a great scene where he sees, like, he takes his daughter, she scrapes her knee in the park, and takes her to a park nurse. And that's my favorite scene in the movie. And it's just this little perfect little weird minute and a half scene that you're like, what the hell? I liked it fine. I agree with Matt Zoller Seitz, who I rarely agree with. I read his review of it, and I thought it was pretty dead on.
Well, I didn't read his review, but I watched it. I watched it today, as a matter of fact, and I admired its look. I mean, this is kind of proof that, like, I don't know. I mean, like, I just think that black and white is just infinitely more interesting than color in a lot of ways. But it kind of started off pretty weird and just got progressively weirder as it goes along. And after a while, I felt and I hated the music. They had to create some kind of music to go over this stuff that's, like, incredibly annoying. Like, even if you can imagine, like, a variation on It's a Small World After All being actually more annoying than the actual song It's a Small World, then
oh dear,
you got this movie. So, but I felt like it was a movie that about, you know, I just thought it was a movie that just kind of wanted to shit all over the whole Disney experience, really, and make it seem weird and trippy, but like strangely also in black and white. And I actually found it gave me a headache watching it. It's rare that a movie does that, like where I was like, oh, this is hurting me now. Like
you're not lifting my skirt. You're not lifting my skirt, gentlemen, about this.
I personally can't recommend the movie, although I will say that the guy who shot it, Lucas Lee Grant or something like that, he's promising.
Lee Grant shot the movie? That's incredible.
I can't remember his last name, but I know it's
Lou
Lucas
Grant.
Lee something.
No, Lee Grant, the actress. I thought you said Lee Grant.
Something like that. It might be Graham instead of Grant. I don't know, but it's something Lucas Lee.
They own the post. Something. Good for them.
You know what interested me, though? In terms of the thematic content of it, I mean, essentially they're taking the happiest place on Earth, the self-described happiest place on Earth, and they're putting what happens when, you know, that facade just turns inward on itself, and it is a facade.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's playing with that, and in that way it reminded me of just the process of going to the movies. I mean, how people talk about escaping into the movies from their real life.
Right.
And what happens when that escape is kind of, it can't help but reflect the turmoil that you're going through in your real life. It kind of,
yeah,
you know,
mm-hmm.
It kind of takes you to another state. And I thought so the movie in a way reflected the whole experience of the facade of movies in a lot of
right.
ways, which I thought was interesting. Probably not intended, but yeah.
No, but I haven't seen it. I've been very curious ever since I first read this about this movie. I'd like to see this. This is on demand, and also there's another one, Blue Caprice. I want to watch. It's on demand
yeah,
at some
me
point.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna check that out. I watched HBO's movie Muhammad Ali's Greatest Fight, which I
yeah, how was that?
I was thinking it was gonna be a documentary, and then I was surprised to see that it's actually a narrative directed by Stephen Frears, and so I didn't really read anything about it going into it, and I was really pleased with it. I didn't think it was like a home run or anything like that, but like for a historical based movie, I thought it took a story that could have been just kind of, if it had focused in on Muhammad Ali as the lead character, and in this movie he only appears in clips, and those clips are kind of electrifying, seeing him, you know, talk and everything. But he only appears in clips, and really the movie takes place in the halls of the Supreme Court and in the back rooms where they're discussing whether to hear the case or not, and then it also kind of avoids kind of sort of courtroom tropes and stuff like that. Like there's very few courtroom scenes. It's all kind of back alley kind of thing, you know. So it's like rooms with shiny tables and all the judges sitting around or even in cafeterias and stuff. But it's also refreshing seeing like like, you know, you don't get to see movies with, you know, this kind of thing used to happen all the time in the 50s, you know, like a whole movie with nothing but 50-year-old guys in it. But that's what this is. I mean, Frank Langella, Fritz Weaver, Barry Levinson is one of the guys, Harris Guillen, Christopher Plummer, that's the other one, and Danny Glover and Ed Begley, and so those are all the justices, you know, sitting around. And I thought it was really good. It reminded me a lot of Stephen Frears' The Queen, in that it took like a real story and peppered it up with a lot of clips. I mean, a lot of clips. And sometimes I find that annoying, but here I didn't, because Ali is kind of at the center of all the clips that they use, most, you know, 9% of them. And he's always compelling to watch. So,
oh, yeah.
So I really dug it. I mean, it's not my favorite movie of the year or anything like that, but I thought it was really good.
I thought it was a nice movie. And, you know, and it gives you a sense of the different perspectives in it when it uses the clips, because here you have a man who, you know, an internationally known figure, controversial figure. You have his fight that he's going through, and that represents something larger. And it's that something larger that the Supreme Court has to grapple with, despite their reservations on even dealing with it in the first place. So there's different like levels that when they interchange between those, the narrative footage and then the Ali stuff, that really brings that to light. I thought it was a very competent, solidly performed movie. I mean, I could easily see it as a stage play. And you know, and,
yeah.
And a great company of actors. It was nice seeing, in the few scenes that he had, it was nice seeing Barry Levinson like act across from Christopher Plummer, and he has a very natural, relaxed way about him. You know,
he does.
It was good. I saw Muscle Shoals too.
Oh, how was that?
Very good. It's just delicious. I mean, it's just delicious to see like behind the scenes stories of. And then Aretha Franklin came in, and no one had any idea what to do with her. And then she cut R-E-S-P-E-C-T, and she found her voice. And it was like, you know, to hear those behind-the-scenes stories, and like these legendary sessions, I just love it. I'm just a sucker for it completely. When the Stones came in to do a Muscle Shoals production, and, you know, it's just how irresistible.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely on the list. I'm going to definitely watch that. I have to get in the mood for a music movie, though, because I don't listen to a lot of music these days, so like I feel like I have to get in the mood for it.
Isn't it amazing how many legendary music figures have died in plane crashes?
Oh, it's hard. I can't get over it. It's amazing. I mean, it's astounding.
Why can't it happen more these days, though?
Why can't it happen
Ray
more?
Dean Treadway advocating the death of musicians he doesn't like.
Jesus.
I want to hear where the plane crash that carries Mumford and Sons. I want to hear about that.
Oh my God! All right, guys, we don't know this guy. Okay, I don't know this Treadway fellow.
Well, why did Jim Croce and Otis Redding have to go that way?
Patsy Cline, Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
I mean, oh my God! And a lot of these people. I mean, all of these people so young. It's like, what could they have done? What could they have come? Here's a question for you. Back to movies, because I was talking about this with my girlfriend a couple of days ago, and it's interesting. I mean, James Dean did 3 films. He died before the 3rd one even opened, I think. What would he have become?
Oh, I can answer this in a heartbeat.
He probably would have become, you know, more of a. He would have become what Dennis Hopper became, I think. You know, I think he probably would have gotten into filmmaking. He probably would have gotten fed up with the star system, maybe. A little bit. He probably would have gotten into a lot more trouble. Probably would have had a major substance abuse problem when the
Yeah, but the difference between I agree.
I actually have an answer for this.
Okay, go ahead.
I've had an answer for this for 30 years. He would have forced Marlon Brando to never get off his game. Marlon Brando would have truly been our Laurence Olivier, because that was his competition. And when Dean died, it was like, okay, I can do whatever the fuck I want. And he did. But this would have been the greatest acting rivalry.
Well, but
it would have changed the course of this.
The big rivalry in actuality, and I don't know if this was drummed up rivalry, but if only because Dean died early, was between Brando and Montgomery Clift. I mean,
but then look what happened, Montgomery. And that, now you're right. But Dean, though, was such an iconic. These two guys, and
yeah.
Then maybe the three of them. Maybe, you know, because I think we don't give, you know, Montgomery Clift doesn't get his due, I think. I don't think he ever gets his due. He was a powerhouse. But I don't think he ever gets his due.
As was Brando. I mean, Brando was self-loathing. I mean, it's obvious. The band.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Clift though, that we forget is he's kind of the first one that arrives on the scene with, at least in the movies, with that sort of methody kind of feel.
Yeah.
I mean, let's remember he was doing movies in the 40s, you know, and Brando didn't come on the screen until the beginning of the 50s. So. Yeah, I mean, I agree. Clift doesn't get his due as being the real. I mean, you know, everybody knows Brando, and you know, even the average person who doesn't watch a lot of movies knows Brando and James Dean. But if you say, "Yeah, but have you ever seen any Montgomery Clift?" They'll go, "Well, no, not really. I've heard his name, but I've never really seen any of his movies, really." So, yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
But I think
Brando,
that's the thing with
Brando, though, he set the theater world on fire. Prior to getting on film, I mean, he was.
Yeah, no, he was. He was huge.
Theater.
I mean, there's that documentary. What is that documentary about Broadway that came out about 10 years ago?
Broadway: The Golden Age. That's
remember they talked about Brando. You think they're talking about? And I won't say that, but they're talking about. They said there was no one like him when Brando came on the scene. People on the Broadway, they were just mesmerized. They said there was no one like that. There was no one like that before. They were just totally blown away by him on stage.
Here's my thought on James Dean. It's hard to say what he would have become. I agree with you that that's a very interesting and likely path, similar to Hopper. But unlike Hopper, I mean, Dean was known as a great powerhouse actor. You know, he was renowned for, this is one of the guys that's changing acting. Which was never necessarily, I mean, in terms of the demographic of filmmaking, I think that was more what Hopper was responsible for shifting. But how much of his legend exists because he died so young, and we never got to see where he would have taken it? You know, it's so that's why it's so hard to quantify.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the fact is, you know, anybody who comes out with their first three movies and they're just so universally loved and on the shoulders of the lead performance in all three of them in particular. Maybe a little less so with Giant because he's really kind of part of an ensemble in Giant. But I mean, like anybody who does that, you know, in the space of
you understand. I mean, if all we had from Pacino was Panic in Needle Park, The Godfather, and Dog Day, or something, or the two Godfathers and Dog Day, or whatever, and then Pacino dies, I mean, there would be no. What many people view as the downfall of Pacino. We wouldn't know his limitations because at that point of his career, he didn't even know his limitations, you know?
Right, right.
But then, of course, we had somebody who, you know, a lot of actors revere that was John Cazale, who was in
five
great movies and was great in all of them, but still didn't get his real due, like in the awards thing or even in the sense of, like, making an impression on the zeitgeist, really. So, and he died early, and you know, not only his compatriots really seem to register the loss, really, his acting compatriots. But I mean, it's still, you know, so his story. So I mean, you know, it's like, you know, it's weird, you know. But who can? I kind of agree, you know, that there's a lot of the legend, and same thing with Marilyn Monroe, and maybe even to a certain extent Bogart, although, you know, he did plenty of movies until, but he still died relatively young. I do think that, you know, the death and speculation about what could have been if had they lived, that's a big part of the legend.
Yeah. I think Monroe would have done really interesting stuff. I think she would have broken away from the powers that be that she felt were holding her down, because she was very serious about the craft of what she did. I think she would have taken some real risks.
I agree with that.
Iconic Monroe image would have majorly shifted somehow. She would have challenged that big time, I think.
Of course, the one thing that she needed to do, and this is the same thing with Clift, which, you know, of course, this is the thing that kind of eventually killed him, but the one thing that she needed to do was clean up, because, I mean, there was she was definitely getting to a point where people were having difficulty working with her because of her, because of her own drug problems, and that would have, I mean, her whole career would have been defined really by whether she cleaned up or not, because otherwise, no one, she wasn't going to get the parts, and no one was going to work with her, and she was considered very difficult, no matter how serious she was. So,
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a really kind of interesting thing to ponder. How would James Dean have been with the new American cinema of the 70s? I mean, he would have been an elder statesman by that point, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think of, like, it's quite possible that without James Dean, if James Dean had still been around, that Jack Nicholson might not have gotten some of the breaks he got. You could easily see... You could easily see maybe James Dean getting the role in Five Easy Pieces, or even in Easy Rider, and actually creating another, that would have been the springboard to another part of his career. Maybe we wouldn't have Nicholson
we wouldn't have Nicholson. If Rip Torn hadn't hurt himself, we might not have Nicholson.
That's true. You know, and that really points out to what role luck and chance plays. I mean, would we have Nicholson without Easy Rider? I mean, I think eventually Nicholson was such an unstoppable, unique force that he would have broken through in something. But it would have been a different career without those early defining movies.
For sure. For sure. So, yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting conversation that engenders.
Yeah. Yeah, just like people like River Phoenix, and, you know, what movies did we miss out from him? What performances did we miss out from him?
Well, that's the other thing. I think that River Phoenix, imagine if he had not. I mean, there are roles I think that he would have gotten. I mean, I think it's really interesting. I think you bring up James Dean. I mean, if he had, those are some very interesting choices, Dean. That's a very interesting path that he would have taken. I mean, I love this What If game.
Mm-hmm.
I do this every day, unfortunately. It shows you how depressed I am on a daily basis. I have to resort to this. But you know what my favorite, you know, I do this What If with our favorite director, George Lucas, wishing that, I always want to, there's an alternative universe I live in where Star Wars is basically this trilogy that existed in the 70s and 80s that no one's ever heard from again. But that's an aside. But I think it's very interesting. River Phoenix, when he died, that was such a shock at the time. I mean, that was a huge blow. Can you imagine what he would have grown up to do?
Well, I think to speak with River, speak to River Phoenix, I think also, you know, similarly with the death of Dean and the possibility that if had he lived, he might have taken some roles from Nicholson. I think had Phoenix lived, he might have taken some roles from Leonardo DiCaprio.
I was thinking that exact same thing, yes.
I feel like Leonardo DiCaprio kind of came in to, like, to sub for
there's
Phoenix
some
in one way.
I would not rule that out.
You know, yeah.
And in many ways, you know, Dean represented the modern American male as we know it today. Because
mm-hmm.
if you think of the difference between male stars of today and yesterday, today they're, and it reflects what American men are today anyway, in general, they're a little more feminized. They are. I mean, they're a lot more kind of open and looser with their emotions. They're not
mm-hmm.
afraid of sensitivity. Dean showed that in his heyday, when he was alive.
If you think of all three of his movies, there's a major breakdown scene where he ends up crying and crumpling into a heap. So
yeah,
that's something that you didn't get very much from actors before James Dean. So they wouldn't allow themselves to go there, you know, really.
Right.
So
he would have been an old man when that era that we're talking about, the sensitization of men occurs. But
mm-hmm.
But if you live that long and you want to stay relevant, you do kind of have to shift and find a different cachet. So he would have had to do that, just like Nicholson. I mean, we talked about this last week, that he represented the anti-hero of the 70s and the kind of the wayward, aimless American male. And then you get to a point, as an older man, that's why something like About Schmidt feels so incredibly different for him.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is an establishment guy. This is a guy that doesn't take chances, that lives under...
Or a few good men, I think, is a very...
Well,
that's not a part we would,
guy, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he would never... I mean, that's a very important thing that you bring up, though, because it's just about people in general. If you're playing... You know, not that it's possible in Hollywood, but if you're playing the same parts in your 60s that you were playing in your 20s and 30s, there's a problem. But it also, we do evolve, hopefully all of us do evolve,
yeah.
Or you don't have the same thoughts. So I think it's very important. Now, having
said
that, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, having said it, though, it's thought that older actors and actresses should not all be reduced to playing grandparents, though.
No, I agree with that. But here's the rub of what you just said. The actors that don't change with the times like that, with their own life cycle, kind of
mm-hmm.
redefine their image, are the ones that don't survive. They constantly kind of shoot themselves in the foot, or they're no longer relevant.
Right.
And I'm thinking about people like Burt Reynolds. I mean, after a while, you can't be the fun-loving playboy that Burt Reynolds always wanted to be.
Right.
And I'm thinking of somebody like Warren Beatty, who demands a certain level of desirability and vanity in every movie, and he's very difficult in demanding that, and you can't stay relevant if you're playing.
No, you can't.
Yeah.
You're right. Well, you're absolutely right.
I mean, it'll be interesting. I'm interested to see what will happen to DiCaprio when he loses his looks and is totally, like, gray-headed, and because I think the same kind of thing might happen with him, you know. I think
yeah,
that
he could.
I think that he relies a lot on that, you know.
I would like to see these guys. What I mean is, I don't like to see, let's be honest, the three of us, we don't like to see Nicholson making movies like The Bucket List. We don't like to see Beatty making movies like Town and Country, which only would have worked in the 70s. It's such a dated movie. It is such a dated movie by the time it comes out. It took forever to make. These guys, though, we would like to see them have one last truly great role, though, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing with Beatty,
Pacino too.
We'll talk about Pacino in a second because I have something to say about Pacino. Here's the thing about Beatty. If he would have let down his vanity and his his OCD level of having to control every single little thing, do you think he would have graduated to the ranks of a Nicholson in terms of performance ability?
Maybe. Not really. I really don't think – my personal thing is that I like a lot of Warren Beatty's movies, but I really feel like he's not – as an actor, I feel like he's – I don't know. He's got a limited appeal in a lot of ways. And it's really the ideas in his movies that keep his movies going forward and not necessarily the performance, with a couple of exceptions. I mean – you know, McCabe is definitely one of his better performances, but and something that I feel like he's doing something a little different in. But generally, I mean, I've always been totally like kind of dumbfounded in a way that, like, whenever you mention Warren Beatty to just about anybody, and I'm talking about like when I would like go to when I was working at movie theaters or when I was working at video stores, when I would say, "Hey, you want to watch this? Is great, you know, I got a copy of Reds here," and they go, "Is that the Warren Beatty thing?" And they go, inevitably, literally 98% of the people go, "Ugh, I hate Warren Beatty," and I'm like, "Wow, people really don't respond to him as an actor, I don't think, you know. I think that Warren Beatty was kind of more famous for being a playboy than anything else. Mm-hmm. I don't think that a lot of it had to do with his acting ability or his filmmaking ability or anything. I think
one of the most genius things he ever did was playing off that image in Shampoo. And I always make Shampoo akin to what Dustin Hoffman did in Tootsie. I mean, Hoffman knew the perception of him as this really difficult perfectionist actor, and he played with that in Tootsie, and the results were terrific, just like they were in Shampoo.
I thought Bulworth was very well done, and I liked, and Bugsy, but that was, we're talking 15, 16 years ago, you know, for Bulworth.
But there's something about great acting. There has to be a lack of vanity in a lot of ways. I mean, there has to be a letting go. And I think when you're so obsessed with directing yourself or only hiring directors that you can push around and get out of the picture, it's very limiting. Because
That's like what's happening with Meryl Streep. Like, if you look at Meryl Streep's output in the past 30 years, she has not, I mean, with very rare exception, maybe working with Charlie Kaufman or whatever, Spike Jones or whatever, with adaptation, but very rarely does she pick a movie with a really, really strong director. I mean, she hasn't done a movie with Scorsese. She hasn't done a movie with, I mean, almost every major director. She hasn't worked with them. She's always in a movie with being directed by, this new one is directed by a guy named John Wells or whatever. You know, I mean, it's like, I don't know. I think she picks directors that she can kind of push around a little bit.
But I also think that she's somebody that challenges, is self-challenging. Like, she sets a bar for herself. But you're right. I mean, outside of people like Altman, who she worked with, and Mike Nichols, who she worked with, I mean, she doesn't work with many great, outstanding directors of note.
No, but in the early years, yeah. I mean,
he did.
Like in the, you know, Pacullo or Cimino or Fred Zinnemann or whatever. You know, she was Robert Benton. You know, those are all really great directors. Yeah, I mean, but that's all in the early part of her career. I'm talking about in the last 25 years or so.
And I'm talking about Prairie Home Companion and Angels in America. So that was in that period. But you're right. In general, you're right. And I find, getting to the thing I want to talk about, Pacino, I find the same is true of Pacino. I wish they, because Pacino is somebody that loves to be directed. I mean, he is a pure actor. So I wish that he'd get with a director that is strong-minded and will challenge him in a different direction. And I think that that's why Barry Levinson, you know, I'm kind of conflicted on Barry Levinson, because I hear that Barry Levinson can be a real pushover. At the same time, there is something that directors do where they like to make the actor feel completely comfortable and in control of their own performance, but all the time they're actually subtly dictating their performance without the actor being aware of it. So I'm curious, mm-hmm. is that what Barry Levinson is? I'm not sure. But, I mean, Pacino's about to do The Humbling with Barry Levinson, where he plays it's based on a Philip Roth screenplay, where he plays He plays a veteran stage actor that begins this experimental sexual affair with a younger actress, and the younger actress is Greta Gerwig. That sounds really promising.
We'll all be in the front row for that one.
Deeb wishes he was Pacino's penis right now. And then he just finished Imagine, which has a great cast, and it seems like a promising, pleasing movie, where he plays like an aging 70s Barry Manilow-esque pop star. And then he's doing the David Gordon Green Manglehorn, which is a dramatic character study with he and Holly Hunter, where Holly Hunter is the lost love of his life that he walked out on years before and has always regretted that. And so I think he's working with interesting people, and I think that will bring about interesting results. I hope, you know. Because
I
know
Gerwig. I still can't get over Pacino and Gerwig in a movie together. That's going to be something else.
Great.
Can we all three of us get preview tickets for that to go together to see that?
I'm tired of people only being reminded of what a great actor Pacino is every 10 or 15 years. Because, I mean, I remember when Donnie Brasco came out and everybody was like, oh, God, occasionally he reminds you that he is a genuinely soulful, great actor. So, I mean, these next three projects are promising to me, but
Let's address that, because when Donnie Brasco comes out, you also have The Insider and Devil's Advocate. And regardless of what you say, Devil's Advocate is a fun role. It's a fun role, and it's actually, let's put it like this, you watch it, you don't regret sitting through that movie. It's fun. But you have The Insider, you have Any Given Sunday, all these movies run at the same time. These are still not... These are still good roles. I don't care what anyone says. They're good roles, and they're not Pacino slumming, regardless. Yeah, later on we do get that. But I think there's still, you mentioned these movies that are going to come out. They're good. And I still think I think Pacino's got at least 10, 15 years of great performances in him. I really do believe that. I think that's true with De Niro, too. I don't think Grudge Match is one of them, but I do think De Niro has something. De Niro has something in him.
Just look at the people he's acting across from. I mean, in Imagine, he's acting across from a couple of really great people, but including Christopher Plummer. So I'd love to see he and Christopher Plummer side by side again, like they were in The Insider. In Manglehorn, he's with Holly Hunter. In this, The Humbling, he's with Greta Gerwig, Diane Wiest, and Mandy Patinkin. It's a good cast. I'm excited.
Yeah. I mean, you can't really... You know, we all want to say, we typecast our actors and actresses, but these are three projects, and I got to say, you know, the idea of a Philip Roth thing is always very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a possibility there, let's put it like that. But all these projects, I think, lend something that they're great, because the moment we write these people off, then this is what they do, and they've given us so much in the past, I'm still optimistic that they can give us something great still.
There's also this. I mean, they've lived long enough and survived in the industry long enough that now the new directors that were so influenced by them in their childhood can come to them and offer them really outside-of-the-box stuff. And I'm sure David Gordon Green is an example of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Are we excited about Blade Runner 2? Is that what it'll be called?
Oh, God, this is... No, why? Go away.
Why get... Why get excited about something that's not going to happen? I just don't believe it's
going to
happen.
You're right.
I'll get excited when they're on the set for the first day, and then I can comment on that. Otherwise, it's just speculation. It's been happening for years, and it'll keep on happening. And it's probably, why do
this from a financial standpoint? I really want to make a sequel to a movie that didn't do well. Let's be very honest.
Point.
Blade Runner is an awesome, awesome movie, and regardless of whatever version you watch or whatever your favorite is, Blade Runner was a dud when it came out.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's a great movie. In the way Hollywood thinks today, I don't know where you, I don't care where you come from, you're going to say, hey, Blade, oh my God, I can fund, that will make me a rich man. I think you will lose more money on this than they lost on the original one.
I agree. I think the original one is basically a cult movie. It's a great movie. I mean, seriously great. But it's also
basically
a cult movie. And,
but there's no reason to make a sequel. There's no reason. If watching that movie, there's nothing that says to me, I want to see. Going on the theatrical version that we all saw in 1982, nothing in that movie that says, I want to see what happens.
Are we going
to
see? We're going to go see them. I don't know. They're going out into the country at the end of the movie.
Is James Woods going to be in the movie with Sean Young? Then I'd pay $500 to see that in the theater opening night. But I really don't give a shit.
The reason why it's news is because Harrison Ford revealed that he is talking to Ridley Scott about being in Blade Runner 2, which is surprising only because you didn't get the sense that they got along or they actually disagreed creatively about the direction of the movie when they're actually doing the movie.
Yeah.
So or how are they going to be on the same page here? And it would have to point out whether or not Deckard is a replicant, which was Ridley Scott's belief that he was, and Harrison Ford didn't believe that. So you got to get over that hurdle before that.
By the way,
who wants a sequel where they actually point? It's like the sequel to 2001, 2010, where they said, get it, and they explained all the things that made the original kind of mysterious and wonderful. And why do we really want a sequel that puts an exclamation point on whether Deckard is a replicant or not? I'd rather leave that up to speculation. That's part
and
of the thing fun
sequels.
About it.
Written by K.W. Jenner, and they're interesting sequels, but there's nothing cinematic in those that says, hey, I want to, movies are, getting much more expensive than I don't see how this is a winning proposition for anyone.
I think a Blade Runner 2 would do better at the initial box office than the first Blade Runner. Now, I don't think that there's any reason to have a Blade Runner 2, but there it is. I don't think there's any reason to have a Big Lebowski 2, but that thing would gross big-time numbers if they actually made it. And that bombed when it first opened, too. But
wait, what is the plot of the Big Lebowski 2?
That's the thing that has much more openings for the possibility of having a sequel.
I'll start camping out now.
Well, of course, they said that they're never going to do a sequel to any of their movies. But
good. God bless them.
With a Blade Runner 2, I just don't see. All it could possibly be is a cash grab, and they're really not going to be grabbing it that much cash because let's face it, the original movie, as much as it's well loved and everything, it's not necessarily for everybody. Not everybody goes nuts over it, and I don't think that it's a movie. It's a brainy movie, and brainy movies don't do that great. It's not going to make $100 million in its first weekend, which is what they want.
I don't know if it's going to make $5 million in its first weekend.
It will make something $20 million.
But you know what? Prometheus reminded me more of a Blade Runner 2 than a sequel to Alien, actually, because Prometheus was ambiguous and more ambiguous and brainier than the first Alien, which was more instinctual and about fright and terror. So it didn't feel akin to Ridley's work on Alien, actually, in Prometheus, and I think that's what turned a lot of people off to it. But, you know, the Coen brothers talk about never doing a sequel to one of their films, but they are working right now on the movie True Regret, which I think is interesting.
Which is what? True regret.
Truer grit.
Truer grit, I get it.
Thank you. God, I really had to sell that joke, did I?
You did. I don't know if you really made the sale on that joke, to tell you the truth. But.
All right, I'll give you a refund.
So is Harrison Ford is he talking any more about his involvement in Episode 7?
Yeah, he said he hasn't decided yet, which probably means he has decided and he's going to do it. But I don't think we're going to get a definitive answer on that. And that set is going to have to be so locked and secure, especially with photogs and everybody trying to snap a photo
They need to go to the other side of the world to go and make it. Like, they need to go to, like, someplace like
Tunisia.
They need to go to Bora Bora or something, because that's where they're going to be left alone. Well, they can go with Edward Snowden and go in Moscow. That's where they should go. Just go hang out in Moscow and make the movie.
Before we leave tonight, I wanted to Stanley Kaufman died. One of the four or five, a handful of, you know, legendary critics in the history of film criticism. What do we think of him?
When we got the New Republic for many years, I always read his reviews, and he's one of the, I won't lie, what I liked about him is the same reason that I like David Thompson. I did not agree with him most of the time, but I learned so much reading him. And I mean, I read all of David Thompson's books, and I have two editions of the Biographical Dictionary of Film. I actually like the fact that I don't agree with him, because it makes me want to read more by him. Mm-hmm. And it was with Kaufman. I look forward to getting the New Republic every week when we got it, because, wow, I really don't agree with this guy, but I'm learning so much, I can't argue with this.
Definitely one of the last of that crew of film critics that wasn't writing to tell you whether to go see the movie or not, but was there to make you think about things and maybe think about things a little differently, and wasn't there to be part of a cabal that gives a rubber stamp to a movie, whether it's good or bad. He was definitely somebody who was contrarian in a lot of things. I mean, he gave negative reviews to both of the first two Godfathers, so he's one of the rare people to do that.
What did he give the third one, out of curiosity?
I don't know. I haven't read that one yet, but
I don't remember. I know I read it, but I don't remember.
I'm sure it wasn't that great.
Well, if he didn't like the first two, I know it for a fact. He wasn't going to say, oh, this is the greatest movie, you know, since Lawrence of Arabia.
he did the kind of film criticism that's basically gone, kind of, in a lot of ways. So, and he's also proof positive, as I've always said, that anybody who gets a well-paying career as a film critic is in that job until they die. They're like popes. They're like, they're going to be there until they die, because it's the perfect job for them. It's paying them. They get published. They get read. And, you know, I mean, like, A.O. Scott is going to be part of, you know, New York Times until he passes away, you know, hopefully, you know, a long time from now. And that's just the way it is. But it's a shame. 97 years, though, that's a long time. 50 years is a
long time. I hope I can be that active on my last day. I mean, that's incredible. I hope he can be that active on.
I tell you what. He was an interesting guy, and he kind of strikes me as the Armand White of his time, and just one sense, in that he was very much a contrarian to popular opinion many times, but and yet he wasn't a complete art snob. Like he would
no,
go
he wasn't.
For quote unquote disreputable films he'd dive into. But hey, I just need to say Wednesday night I'll air David Thompson's interview. The next 2 weeks we're going to do a Best of Movie Geeks United series, and we'll be back live on the first weekend of November 3rd.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow, we'll have a lot to talk about then. All right.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. See you in a couple of weeks.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.